Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Rags to Riches, Bootstrap Success, Moving On Up. The language of economic and social class in the United States is all about climbing. But new evidence suggests that class mobility in America may have stalled since the mid-1970s. And in that stall, some funny things are happening with class in America, and some not so funny. The New York Times is in the middle of a 10-part series exploring how class shapes Americans' education, wealth, health, lifespan, religion, politics, even marriage. We're digging in. Tonight on Point, class in America, who's up, who's down, and the new state of the American dream. You can join the conversation. Are you class conscious? Are you tuned in to the economic ranks in society? And which rung of the ladder do you figure you're on? How's life there? And how far do you believe you can rise? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Tom Kuntz, assistant editor for news at the New York Times. He's overseen the paper's 10-part Class in America series. Tom Kuntz, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also joining me from New York is Tamar Lewin, a reporter at the New York Times. She wrote two articles that have run in the series. One profiled a woman who grew up poor in Kentucky and returned to her hometown as an affluent lawyer. Her other long piece tells the story of a cross-class marriage. Tamar Lewin, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Tom Kuntz, take us in here. What is it that's going on with class in America that has the New York Times devoting a 10-part series to it? What caught your eye? What took you in?
Well, I've always been interested in class. I always thought it was something that Americans in general don't talk about, and journalists in particular don't cover. And when I heard that the paper was interested in doing a series about class, I raised my hand because we have a lot of divisions in the society that we talk about, race, gender, et cetera, ethnicity. But underlying that is class, and class is the air you breathe, but we don't really comment on it. And so I thought it was important to look at it, especially at a time when our economy's changing on a scale that probably rivals the Industrial Revolution. And how does that change the social order? And that's why we decided to look at this subject.
There's a lot of texture to it, and Tamar Lewin has brought a lot of that in her stories. But let me ask you first. I think the thing that caught my eye was this hook about the new interpretation of what's going on with mobility. Americans are famously tolerant of income gaps, of wealth gaps, as long as they think they have a shot at the brass ring. And for a long time, the sort of received wisdom was that that was exactly right, that Americans did have that shot. What's the new interpretation that's changed thinking about class mobility, Tom?
Well, what's pretty clear is that mobility was rising throughout the post-war period until the 70s, and then it kind of flattened off. Economists only recently realized that they weren't measuring class with any kind of precision to know what was really going on. And so they've recently revised that with better data and have found that mobility, that is moving from one economic group to another quintile, has stagnated, flattened, or perhaps declined. Now, I guess it's an eye of the beholder type thing. People could say, well, opportunity is not rising as it was, and that's anti-American practically. Mm. But on the other hand, mobility maybe is as high as it was in the 70s, and people weren't complaining about that. The thing that's happening now is that our economy is changing, and there's an income disparity that, you know, raises concerns about where this is all going to lead.
So if you've got even greater disparities and but no more mobility to go with that, I see at the same time the Wall Street Journal's dipped in here, my old friend David Wessel writing that now any number of European countries and Canada have more social or class mobility, it would appear, than the United States. Tamar Lewin, you've gotten up close and personal with a number of people reporting this class story. When you went out with your reporter's eye and began looking around for indicators, for stories, narratives that would explain what's going on, what did you find?
Well, it was really interesting. When I was looking for cross-class couples, there's quite a lot of them out there, and I had no trouble finding couples in which the working class member was filled with ideas about class and how they were different from their spouse and what it meant and where it came from. And in almost all of them, the middle class or upper middle class person was very uncomfortable with even thinking along those lines. And they'd say, oh, no, yeah, we're different, just like my spouse said. But I don't think it's class. I think it's religion, it's gender, it's geography, it's education. It's a personal difference. There's no class differences here. And ultimately, to find a couple where both of them were sort of tuned into it took a very long time, and I ended up with a couple that had actually gone to a workshop on cross-class relationships. And I came later to think that was no accident. They'd learned to see that way. But it became very clear after you talked to lots of couples that there's differences in every couple. And you tend to think, oh, that's just how I am,
just
the way you do things.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But really, it's much less moderated by your personality or that this is the rock solid way you do things than what your growing up class culture showed you. And there's no absolute about any of it, but you didn't make it up. And there are other ways of doing things, and a lot of them are dictated by class.
I want to ask you about that because it's such a great tableau. These Dan and Kate, who you went into depth on their marriage. Kate came from a well-to-do family. Dan from just the opposite. It was their second or third marriage for each of them, as I recall. And, you know, they said they had a lot of things in common, as you said. Dancing, motorcycles, Bob Dylan, bad puns, liberal politics in their case, and national public radio. But still, as their relationship deepened, they found a lot of terrain of class differences that I found illuminating for the whole country. Describe some of those for us, Tamar.
Well, first it took a while for them to notice it, and then it took a while for them to learn to talk about it. But it became clear to them that, well, money, of course, is a big one. And Kate really had always had enough, and Dan had really always kind of lived on the edge. And she was tremendously generous about it, but her sense of the world and her safety in the world were very different from his sense that you could fall off at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Their sense of how much they were in their families was quite different.
What do you mean
and
by that?
You're right that they both had been married twice before, and they each had two children from previous marriages. Mm. And in the end, or that is, it's not the end, it's a happy middle, but his kids, he has two daughters, and they have 12 cousins, and they're the only ones who went to college. And they are straddling now their old life, and they're very, very immersed in Kate's whole extended family.
That is, his children who grew up not in that affluence, but now have one foot in Kate's affluent world.
That's right.
Does it feel weird for them? Are they very aware that they're in two worlds?
They're very, very aware of it. And sometimes their differences with their family makes them feel like outsiders in their own world.
Do they feel bitter? Do they feel like aliens, like deprived people?
I don't think they feel bitter. I think they feel quite close to some of their cousins. But when all their cousins get married right out of college, they're in their middle and late 20s and not married, and that feels funny. But a thing that surprised me was, although they live right near Dan's extended family, Kate's boys, who grew up with plenty of everything, are very much not involved in them. And they sort of haven't fallen into his world the way his girls have fallen into their world.
What does that mean? Is it the gravity, the pull of money that pulls them in, or the Kate's boys have money, so they're just off doing their own thing? They don't care as much about family ties?
I don't think it's just money. It's a different way of life that's a lot of it is about education. One of the big things that we found in the series that was just kind of knocked your eyes out was how important a college education was in making your way in the United States and how class-bound your opportunity for that is. And so while lots of people go to college in this country, they may go to community college, and if they do, they're not very likely to get through, even though they think they will at the beginning, to get through a four-year college. Well, Dan's girls are not only through college, they're in graduate school. Mm-hmm. They're going to do just fine. But so they view the world differently because of that.
Tom Kuntz, I want to put it to you here. Tamar is describing in other parts of the series, you've written about health issues and that the wealthy, the upper class, not only live better, they actually live longer these days with their access to better diets and better health care. Here, Tamar is pointing to something just as fundamental, a fundamental sense of safety in the world. Wow, to have that throughout a life is an incredibly valuable thing, a priceless thing. These would seem to be fundamental dividers between class.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked about Tamar's story, it illuminated cross-class differences, but it also was a window onto how children are raised in different parts of the socioeconomic spectrum. I mean, richer kids tend to feel more entitled. They tend to question authority. And poorer kids are more deferential to authority. They, you know, their parents are less likely to encourage, you know, a questioning attitude toward authority. And this all seems to have an impact on their chances in life. Not only that, but the money. I mean, one of the terms we've coined in this series is inherited meritocracy, where people with money and resources are able in a meritocracy yeah. to cultivate children of merit. And
so they can live by the merit rule, but also kind of inherit that status at the same time. Tom Kuntz, Tamar Lewin, please stand by. Tom and Tamar with us from the New York Times. Their big series is Class in America. We're talking tonight about wealth, mobility, who's up, who's down, and how the American dream is playing out today. You can join us tonight. How high do you want to go? Are you confident that the system will let you get there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about class in America, about wealth, mobility, who's up, who's down, and how the American dream is playing out today. You can join us tonight. Are you class conscious? Are you tuned in to the economic ranks in American society? Are the gaps getting wider? Is mobility tougher? And with the price of top colleges, top health care, top housing so high, is it harder now to move between classes or not? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from New York City by Tom Kuntz and Tamar Lewin of the New York Times, a big 10-part series rolling out in the Times over the last week and days to come, looking at American class today from an awful lot of angles. We're joined as well right now from Berkeley, California, by Michael Hout. He's professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. He's author of Following in Father's Footsteps, co-author of Inequality by Design. Michael Hout, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
It's great to have you. I wish you'd take us a little more into the numbers here. We see it everywhere. The Times has got it. The Wall Street Journal, big headline, class mobility stalls. What are the numbers? What's the understanding of what's really going on with Americans' tendency or capacity to move between economic classes, Michael Hout?
Well, there are three parts to the social mobility story, and we seem to be stalling on all three fronts. First of all is economic growth, with no growth in overall incomes, or at least in the median income, for the last 5, 6, 7 years. That engine of mobility, the rising tide that lifts all boats, stalled.
Okay.
People aren't moving up that way. But more importantly, the opportunities seem to be more generally inherited across class lines, across generations, so that this inherited meritocracy that that the previous speakers were talking about, I'm sorry, I missed the introductions, is verified in these data.
You're saying opportunity, that's number two. And the third?
And then the third part is just the absolute gap between the between economic classes are growing, so that, for example, one common measure of it is to look at what a worker at the 90th percentile, a relatively affluent worker, makes compared to what a less well-off worker or a working poor person makes. Those ratios used to be in the neighborhood of 3.5 or 4-1. They've grown to 5 to 5.5 to 1 in recent years.
Now, what's happened with the understanding of the research? Here I'm reading from Gary Becker, University of Chicago, Nobel laureate in economics. In 1986, he wrote, "Almost all the earnings advantages or disadvantages of ancestors are wiped out in 3 generations, in the USA, that is. Poverty would not seem to be a culture that persists for several generations." Now he's saying he may be changing his mind. So what's changed in the understanding of the basics there?
I think that one of the things that's happened is that the data have gotten better. 3 generations was a real stretch 20 years ago to make a statement like that. But more importantly is the real rise in the cost of a university education and in some of the patterns of people who are getting diverted into community colleges instead of four-year colleges, especially people who have modest means. And that does seem to be a barrier to their chances for upward social mobility.
Tamar Lewin, Tom Kuntz was talking about this phrase you all are using, inherited meritocracy. It sounds like a contradiction in terms. Your series finds that it's not. What does it mean?
It means that when you have a fair amount of wealth and you can invest it in your children, you can give them all kinds of advantages. You can give them the tennis coaching, you can give them the SAT prep courses, you can give them the experiences that will look wonderful on their resume, and most of all, you can give them a huge number of a big network of connections to plug into. So if you just look at those kids, they're gonna look like they have a higher place in the meritocracy, even if they themselves haven't had a whole lot to do with it. Whereas if you have a kid who didn't have any of that coaching, didn't have any of those extracurriculars, didn't have any of that prepping, doesn't have any of that connections, was working at a grocery store to make money, they're not going to look as glossy and able to fit in to a lot of opportunities. And it's not because they don't have, you know, the same aptitude, the same possibilities, really. It's just that their circumstances haven't given them very much.
And yet, Americans are big believers in mobility, in the chance at the brass ring. And in your own reporting, you show, Tom Kuntz, that there's all kinds of indicators. I mean, what here I'm reading from you say there are more self-made billionaires today, only 37 members of last year's Forbes 400, a list of the richest Americans, only 37 inherited their wealth on the list last year, down from almost 200 in the mid-1980s. That would make it sound as though Americans can stand up and get rich.
It is true. There is, I think one of the economists we quote said anytime there's great turmoil in an economy, there's going to be people who get very rich off it. It doesn't mean that everybody is, you know, becomes a zillionaire or anybody has greater chances to move up in class. America is a mobile society, and we're not saying that it isn't. One of the things that we have noticed is that's one of the things that clouds what's really going on. You know, the economic changes we're still in the middle of is clouding the actual picture. People see a lot of opportunity. They watch American Idol on television. Mm-hmm. They have greater access to credit. They can. It's hard to tell whether the people with the same car have it on credit or have bought it outright.
Right.
There's greater home ownership because credit companies are better able to assess risk. Cheaper goods. All these things cloud the class picture, and obviously, the churning at the top also lends the impression of a lot of opportunity, but really the mobility picture hasn't changed much.
And, of course, we really celebrate those success stories. That's part of the American tradition as well. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Bruce is calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I guess what my comment was is that I guess where I grew up, well, I haven't grown up yet, but I mean where I grew up was, I grew up where, when I was younger, we used to take baths out of a 5-gallon pickle bucket in a hotel bathroom, and, on the way to church, you'd go ahead and stop off at a truck stop to go ahead and take a shower there because you didn't have that.
So this was not a gold-plated growing up.
No, but what's strange about it is the fact that, hey, I'm not. So as far as one comment, as far as being class conscious, no, I'm not class conscious. I figure that I can go ahead and accomplish whatever I want to accomplish.
Yep.
But there's the idea that, hey, I'm a chiropractor. I'm an acupuncturist. I should be finishing up my medical degree next year. I'm 41. Last night I went to bed at 2 o'clock and got up this morning at 6, and so I'm still chugging along. And so that's for me, and that's I'm fairly decently accomplishing. And then
feel like you've got mobility.
Yeah, and then it's like my older brother, he got his bachelor's degree, he's getting his master's degree. My younger brother, he's got 60 or 70 acres, and he's got his bachelor's degree. And my younger sister, she got her bachelor's degree, and she got her master's degree, and she was actually interviewed, I think, by Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. And so it's strange of the fact that out of a very humble surroundings, I mean, we're accomplishing a fair amount as a family. I think it's very fascinating.
It's terrific for you, and when you hear this kind of telling of the American mobility story, the class story, do you say, well, I don't see that picture, Bruce?
I see that if you're willing to work hard enough, it's able to be done. As I said, it's like, hey, I'm not young, but I'm not old, definitely. And hey, last night I got to bed at 2. And so if you work hard enough, I mean, none of us got any grants, or I guess we got grants maybe, but we had student loans, but nobody gave us any money for college. And so there is upward mobility that's available as long as you're willing to work your buns off.
And we hear it, and you still feel like you're moving right on up, and we're glad for that. Bruce, thanks very much for your call. Michael Hout. How about it? I'm sure that there are, I don't know, millions of Americans who would say, amen, that's my story too.
Absolutely, and that's always been the case. The problem is that right now it's slowing down. That engine is in stall mode right now. We're not moving forward as fast, and we're not moving as many up as we used to. In the 1960s, the ratio of upward movers to downward movers was about 9-1, and today it's about 2.5-1. That is to say, the upwardly mobile outnumbered the downwardly mobile by 9-1, and now they outnumber the downwardly mobile 2.5-1. So it's still a better than gloomy picture. It's just not as rosy as it once was.
Not what Americans were accustomed to. Count your lucky stars if you're in that upwardly mobile 2.5 times. Alita's calling from Sutton, Massachusetts. Hi, Alita. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Well, my comment was about the experience that I've had with my husband. I'm from an intellectual, educated background. My dad was a professor. My mom was a teacher. And I was always taught, equality and all that. I'm in my late 40s.
Right.
And I had all these, most of my life I did a lot, I had a lot of relationships that were inter-class. And finally, when I was 40, I got married to a man that is from a very poor background. And it was very interesting how when we had a child, things really started to change because all of a sudden all my childhood expectations of a middle class upbringing kicked in, and we had an argument tonight about a water bottle from my brother's store, and I'm like, I've had that bottle for 10 years, and I know it has mold in the bottom of it, but I saved that stuff, and you don't have anything from your childhood, and which is unfortunately true. His family moved from place to place. And when we get
and you feel, if I may ask, Alita, you had, it sounds like, a middle class or verging on affluent childhood. His was poor.
Right.
And the core of it boils down to what? He expects your children to do with less, or he gives them more?
The core is actually that it's amazing how he's learning to live in the suburbs and that there's... that we want different values, and he does want values for his daughter with me of how important education is and where we live and things like that have changed. However, his family, and very sadly for us, is he has children that still from previous marriage that already have had problems with education, et cetera, and they're probably not going to get out of that situation. I'm not sure how to explain how to tie it all together, but...
No, I hear it. So different expectations there and different paths that you've walked to get to where you are today. I want to bring Tamar Liu in, because Tamar, you got into great depth with one couple, which sounds like your couple, Tamar, may have had even greater disparity of wealth in their background. But I wonder what your question is for Alita here. She feels like she's grappling with a similar dynamic.
Yeah, the... Besides the story about the cross-class marriage, I did another story about a woman who started out very poor and came back and is raising her niece and nephew, who also started very poor, mm-hmm. but she's now in the process of making them middle class. I think what I came out most noticing about all this is there really are very different models of what parenting is all about. And many couples find that it is with the arrival of kids that the differences become really profound. And the middle class view is that you cultivate them and you guide them and you're very involved in that. Mm-hmm. And the working class view is much more that you provide the room and it's kind of up to them. And
let them grow up more on their own.
Yeah. And I think it's a really useful thing for people from different classes to be thinking about sort of stepping back and trying to figure out why they think what they think and actually what it is that they think. Because you do take for granted what you believe about child rearing. And to try to actually talk it out is a very good exercise.
Alita, it sounds like that's right in the middle of your marriage. Do you think that, I mean, you know, some people have said sometimes these affluent children end up too pampered.
Sure. And we're trying to expose our daughter to all different culture, but we do protect her from anything that we think is not safe for her. So we're trying to raise her open about her. Like a couple weeks ago, we went to Puerto Rico because that's my husband's descent. We want her to be
yep.
proud of her heritage,
sure.
To not look down on people that don't have as much as her. But, yeah, she is definitely leading a more affluent life. We're getting, you know, she plays soccer and is going to take horse lessons. She's only five.
So already she's aware, and it sounds like a little bit on the inherited meritocracy track there. Alita, thanks very much for calling. Arlene is calling from Reedsburg, Wisconsin. Hi, Arlene, you're on the air.
Hi. Great show. I wanted to just mention a book, something that I attended at UW Extension had a class that was open to the public, and it was a book based on a book called Bridges Out of Poverty.
Okay.
When we all attended this class, it was about 3 years ago, we took a test. Could you survive in poverty? Could you survive in middle class? Or could you survive in wealth? And everyone in the class passed the middle class test. And the question, what it did was make us more sensitive to what the differences were. And yes, I definitely believe that there's a class difference in our society.
And was your sense from your classmates there, Arlene, that they understood what was going on in the class beneath them, that they were in tune with it?
Well, it was an eye opener for all of us because we had no idea how difficult the struggle is and how difficult it is to get out of poverty and how you're so connected and bonded to these family connections. And you do have to, as they say, rise above your raising. You have to leave all of that if you really want to get out of poverty.
But sometimes just living in different worlds. Arlene, our time is running short here, but I appreciate your call. We're coming up to a break, but Michael Hout, I wanted to ask you, is it possible to kind of give us a snapshot as if from 50,000 feet of what the class structure of the United States looks like now? How would you describe the terrain, high, middle, low, the dimensions of each?
Well, we usually do it in terms of of the relative rankings and the amount of money it takes to get into the affluent category these days has been rising steadily and is now in the for family income is about $110,000 or $125,000
to be considered affluent.
And you're
saying
down at that point at about the other 90% of Americans.
So you're talking the top 10% to be considered affluent these days.
Yes.
And then what's the rest look like? The big bulge? Is the middle class still the middle class that the boomers
sure,
grew up with, or does it look different?
There will always be a middle, especially by this definition. You can always find the middle. It's just
But I mean the dimensions and size.
People, the amount of money between the top and the middle is greater. It's now over $50,000, whereas 20 years ago that gap was more on the order of about $30,000.
And Tamar Lewin, you find in the series that the indicators of class have changed, though. It's not as necessarily as simple to just observe who's in what class.
No, you can't tell from consumer goods anymore as much as you used to be able to. You can't tell from the cars. You can't tell from the cell phones. You can't tell from the clothes. You can tell quite a lot, however, from the pedigree of education.
That really the indicator. Tom Kuntz, you find that across the board?
Sure, I agree with that. We arrived at a definition of class, which is subjective, and anybody can take issue with it, but it's respected by a lot of sociologists. It's imagine yourself with a hand of four cards, education, occupation, wealth, and income. Those things determine your class. If you have aces, if you have a hand of aces, you're in the upper class. If you have a hand of twos, you're in the lower class. But in America, in an increasingly complex economy, there's a lot of variation among those cards, and that's part of what makes it hard to tell.
Well, we're all in that poker game tonight. Tom Kuntz, Tamar Lewin, Michael Haupt, please stick with us. We've got a short break here. We're talking about class in America. Listeners, you can join us. What's your story, your example of how class works in America today? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about class in America, about wealth, mobility, who's up, who's down, and how the American dream is playing out today. You can join us tonight. Did you know that mobility between classes has flattened, has stagnated? Can you feel that in your life, in your neighborhood? And if mobility is flat, does fairness become a bigger issue? Are we headed deeper into a stratified society? Is the American dream still working? What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from New York by Tom Kuntz and Tamar Lewin of the New York Times, a big 10-part series the Times is rolling out these days about class in America, and from Berkeley, California by Michael Haupt, professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. You could join us as well. Steve's calling right now from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. It seems to me that the people that have money tend to work a lot harder and work a lot more. I guess I'm in that top 10%, but I work till 7 o'clock tonight. I got dirt under my fingernails, and I'll be one of the few guys at my operation working tomorrow.
I hear you. And so you are you earning it in a limo, or are you earning it by the hour?
I am earning it by the hour. I'm in a service business down on Cape Cod. I can't find people who want to work and put the hours in. I came up here after I finished college, so I guess I had that leg up.
Right.
But I spent 2 years working nights in a warehouse to get there. I still was on my hands and knees troweling something out today. And I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more about how these guys examined their data, because I would bet that if you make $25,000 a year,
yeah,
because you're not working 2,000 or 2,500 hours a week, or perhaps your wife's staying at home or the
right.
husband's at home,
right,
and you're limiting the amount of hours you can work. My wife is from Sweden, a very different upbringing than I had,
mm-hmm.
and we are very fond of saying, I speak Swedish, we speak Swedish with my kids, but the fact of the matter is there's no place in the world where you can be successful in spite of yourself, but America.
so work those hours and bring it home.
And go to work and hump it out and get it done.
Yeah, I hear it. And taksamika for the word there, Steve. Let me put that to Michael Haupt. Michael, there's a view. Just, you know, pick up the trowel, get busy, work the hours, and you can bump up across those class lines. Just put in the labor.
Well, if you put in the labor at the right school, you might. We did a survey here at Berkeley in 2001 in which we asked people how many hours they were working and how happy they were with that work schedule. And what we found was that the most affluent people sounded a lot like the last caller. They were putting in 8, 9, 10-hour days and the 2,500-hour years. Meanwhile, people who are not making as much money were in fact
lucky to get in 30 hours a week or 35, but it wasn't for lack of trying. It was that the boss was not calling on them. They weren't handing them the trowel to get that work done. They were in fact starved for hours. These folks told us that they were willing to work 45 hours a week, and they couldn't find that extra 10. They would love some overtime. They would love even to many of them actually were looking for second jobs in order to supplement their families' incomes. He also the previous caller also raised an important issue mentioning his wife. One of the biggest factors in the current class structure in the United States is the gap between married people and unmarried people, and the fact that their educations tend to be correlated also if they are married, so that the hours-starved folks were disproportionately single, and those who were married were married to other people who were looking for a second job, as opposed to the college grads who were looking for maybe a second babysitter.
Steve also mentioned his wife from Sweden, and we come back there to the sort of relative mobility, class mobility in different societies. I'm looking here at the Wall Street Journal again, but saying that Europe has actually, in a number of countries, moved ahead of the United States. Now, Steve is repeating tonight what Americans grow up believing and certainly want to believe, that they've got the most, you know, mobile society, the greatest opportunities in the world. Here, Michael Hout, if I read this correctly, Canada and the Nordic countries, even France and Germany, more mobility, class mobility than the United States today. That's kind of shocking to me.
Not Germany. Leave Germany out of that.
All right.
But the Nordic countries look an awful lot like the United States, although the gaps between the ladders on the class rung are a lot closer together in Sweden. But England, France look very much like the United States.
Well, that's interesting. If the rungs of the ladder are closer together, maybe it's not as hard to move classes. Let's get another call. Andrew's calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just kind of surprised at what I'm hearing tonight, because I recently graduated from UMass Boston, and our sociology courses, again, they explicitly stated that the Horatio Alger kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, rags to riches thing is just a myth, and that it's just supports the ideology of individualism when, in fact, most Americans work very hard for most of their lives, long hours, and they don't make a lot, and they don't really get ahead.
But we've got one of the richest countries in the world here, an awful lot of rich people. We're looking here at the Forbes 400, lots of new members on there. Andrew, there seems to be evidence in both directions. Are you eager to believe that rags to riches is reality, or does it seem to you that it's not?
Well, my reality has been, for most of my 20s, rather low-wage jobs and a lot of hard work and toil, and knowing and seeing a lot of other people in that condition. And what I was taught in school, like I was saying, is that upward mobility has more to do with structural mobility, with movements in society and history that don't have to do with individual labor and effort and choice, but have more to do with where history is going, where industry is going. Like, for instance, what's happening now with outsourcing? How's that going to affect upward mobility compared with, say, industrialization or the movement from the Great Depression to World War II and all the people who went from the bread lines to the shipyard making munitions?
Find yourself at the right place at the right time and the right moment in history. You'll be better off, but that is hard to control. Tom Kuntz, what about this issue of faith in the system, in the kind of American dream? Andrew's saying he's looked at it and been told it's kind of an illusion, but we're getting plenty of other callers tonight saying, I believe.
Oh, yeah, we did a poll on class in America, polled about 1,200 Americans across the country, and they're very optimistic about their chances for upward mobility, and I look at that positively. I mean, I think if they weren't so upbeat, there'd probably be less success stories than there are now. he said something interesting about outsourcing. Mm. Keep in mind that as these jobs go abroad, they're creating new middle classes in India and other countries in Asia, for example.
Rapidly.
And fewer opportunities for people without education here, because those jobs are gone.
just out the door. I was also struck really by the health issues and the lifespan issues. Michael Hyde, I don't know if you pay attention to that, but the Times is reporting here that sort of with every jump in class, you've got a better quality of life in health terms and increasingly just simply a longer life. I mean, this is the thing you can't put a price on.
It's not my area, but I certainly was interested to read it in the Times, and also it's one of the hottest areas in social science research right now. We had a conference here in Berkeley last week where a number of the people who are doing this work came to town and presented the latest on it, and it's incontrovertible evidence that class matters for health, but I'm not on top of the numbers.
Tom, one of the really interesting things I noticed about the health and class issue was that it's not just a question of money. It's culture. It's your ability to pull strings, access the system. Talk to your doctor. It's your diet. It's your health. It's all those other kinds of class-based things that raise implications for how we will ensure health care for Americans, because it's not just a question of money.
Mm. Tamar Lewin, take us past the numbers for a minute. You spend so much time with people talking about this. What's your sense of how Americans are thinking about class today? Are they? We heard about the optimism that so many express from Tom Kuntz, but when they look across class lines, when they look up, when they look down, do they feel empathetic? Do they feel resentful? Do they feel guilty? Do they feel like, hey, we're all in this together? Just describe some of that inter-class thinking.
It's hard to generalize. There is a strong sense, as one of your callers said, most people believe that with a lot of hard work, you can get ahead. This is less true, probably, of immigrants who've come here, worked very, very hard, and not gotten ahead.
Mm.
There's not as much class resentment as I thought there would be. People seemed in some way to accept that this was just how the world was. Again, we're not just talking income mobility. We're here. Mm-hmm. We're talking the whole constellation of wealth and occupation and everything. There was a strong sense that other people didn't really understand. People from outside my class don't understand my class. That's a pretty widely held feeling. And there was some sort of irritation. We set up a reader's sort of web forum, and there's a lot of people talking about their frustration that they can't seem to get across how it feels to them, to anybody who's from a different class. But it doesn't seem to – it seems to be frustrating rather than infuriating.
Mm. Michael, how – Tom, please, yeah.
Tom, one of the things we really came away with in the series was that class is like the air you breathe. You don't really notice it until you venture outside of your comfort zone. And Tamar's two pieces illustrate that quite vividly. But, for example, we had a reporter down with a Tennessee National Guard unit, and these guys didn't feel any class resentment at all. A lot of the upper class people we talked to said, "What do you mean class?" And I think it has to do with how much you encounter other classes when you really notice class,
and how much you really understand about what's going on in their lives, in their checkbooks, in their bank accounts.
I start my class with my course on class with the line that people you know is a lousy sample. You can't run a poll based on the folks you know.
Yeah, but people live by what they know, and that faith remains pretty indestructible, at least so far. But interesting to watch. Michael Hout at Berkeley, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Tom Kuntz and Tamar Lewin, a terrific series. We'll keep reading. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
In a moment, a message of peace from the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. This is On Point. The grandson of Mahatma Gandhi is traveling the world these days, carrying the message of nonviolence that Gandhi used to help free India from British colonial rule. This week, Arun Gandhi was in Providence, Rhode Island. He told stories of life with his famous grandfather, and he challenged the audience there to examine their own contribution to what he called a global culture of violence.
Grandfather said, respect, understanding, acceptance, and appreciation. We have to respect ourselves and respect each other and respect our connection with all of creation. Now that's very important, because a lot of people, especially here in the United States, tell me that we are independent individuals and we can do whatever we like and it's nobody's business. Now, we are not independent individuals. We are interdependent, interrelated, and interconnected. And we have to respect that. I was 13 years old when I had the opportunity to go and live with Grandfather. And the first lesson that he taught me happened one day when I was coming back from school. I had a notebook and a pencil in my hands, and I was walking home absentmindedly, and I happened to look at that pencil, and it was about 3 inches long. And without a second thought, I just threw that pencil away, because I was so sure that Grandfather would give me a new pencil when I asked him for one. But that evening when I went and asked Grandfather for a new pencil, instead of giving me one, he subjected me to a lot of questions. And I couldn't understand why he was making such a fuss over a little pencil until he told me to go out and look for it. And I said, "You must be joking." He said, "You don't expect me to look for this little pencil in the dark?" He said, "Oh yes, I do. Here's a flashlight. Take this flashlight and go out and look for the pencil." And I must have spent about 2 hours searching for the pencil, and when I finally found it and brought it to him, he said, "Now I want you to sit here and learn two very important lessons. The first lesson is that even in the making of a simple thing like a pencil, we use a lot of the world's natural resources. And when we throw them away, we are throwing away the world's natural resources, and that is violence against nature. And the second lesson is that because in an affluent society we can afford to buy all these things in bulk, we overconsume the resources of the world, and because we overconsume them, we are depriving people elsewhere of these resources, and they have to live in poverty, and that is violence against humanity." Now, physical violence is something that we understand. All the wars and killings and beatings and murders and rapes and all of these things where physical force is used against people is physical violence. But passive violence is something that we tend to ignore. The resources, the overconsumption of resources, and discrimination, oppression, suppression, economic, political, social, cultural, religious, all of these things that we do every day. And then Grandfather explained to me the connection between the two. He said that we commit passive violence every day, consciously and unconsciously, and that generates anger in the victim. And the victim then resorts to physical violence to get justice. And so it is passive violence that fuels the fire of physical violence. So logically, if we want to put out the fire of physical violence, we have to cut off the fuel supply. And the fuel supply comes from each one of us. And that is why he said, unless we become the change that we wish to see in the world, we cannot really work for peace there. We are trying to put out the fire by pouring water on it, and yet on the other hand we are pouring fuel onto the fire also. And so the fire never goes out.
Arun Gandhi is the grandson of India's Mahatma Gandhi. He spoke earlier this week at the Community Church of Providence in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.